What's up, guys? This is Justin, co-founder of Twitch. You're listening to my podcast, The Quest, where we talk about the human journey behind every trailblazer. We've been told that we're the Zen version of how I built this. What we care about here is wellness, vulnerability, the story of making it, and what happens afterwards. So today I want to give a quick shout out to Brian and Maggie at the Asian Hustle Network. AHN is our first ever community partner, and it's a Facebook group to celebrate Asian stories. We did an exclusive live stream of this episode today with the group. I'm a huge fan of their work, and you should definitely check out their podcast if you haven't. Also, please leave us a comment and let us know who and what you want to hear about over at The Quest Pod on IG, Twitter, LinkedIn, and everywhere else. And as always, you can find me at Justin Khan on Twitter, TikTok, Instagram, all of the social platforms. We've been running a weekly newsletter for episode summaries and my own writings from time to time, so you can subscribe to that, The Quest Digest, in our show notes. Today, our guest is one of my favorite people, Laura Behrens Wu. Laura is the founder of Shippo, the e-commerce plugin that powers tens of thousands of businesses around the world and is responsible for sending millions of shipped packages across 196 countries. I've known Laura for a couple of years as an entrepreneur, and I admire her grit breaking into Silicon Valley at 22 and growing into a leader that embraces vulnerability. Without further ado, here's Laura. Please enjoy. Laura, what's up? Thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me. I did not know that we'd have a live audience, but I'm very excited. Who have you had on the show before this?
I have had Steve Huffman from Reddit, Michael Seibel from YC, the guys from the Chainsmokers, my friend Arlen Hamilton, who's a VC at Backstage Capital. We just did one with Mark Cuban, and I'm going to have Jewel on soon, the musician. So I don't know, a lot of different people. And I have my meditation teacher on. It's like a total random mix of just whoever is around and that I find interesting that I want to talk to. The podcast is like really an excuse to have a deeper conversation with friends of mine, you know?
Yeah, you mentioned that you want to talk about, you want to go beyond just like what people talk about at dinner conversations. You want to go like below the surface and talk more about the struggle. So I'm excited to see what kind of questions you have.
Perfect. Yeah, that's the, you know, you don't get very many opportunities to have like a 60 or 90 minute conversation where you're just asking questions to your friend and trying to learn more about them. And so I really enjoyed that part of it.
Yeah. And the two of us have met at dinners or like in group conversations a bunch of times, but I don't think we've had like a deep one-on-one conversation just yet.
Exactly. So I listened to the podcast you did where you told the whole story of Shippo, but just for the audience and the listeners out there, can you tell us a little bit about how you started your company and how you came to Silicon Valley?
Yeah, of course. So I'm originally from Germany. I honestly have never been to Silicon Valley before until 2014. And I was working at a few different startups in Europe, in Berlin and in Zurich. And I, you know, you read about Silicon Valley and TechCrunch and it seems like this utopia, this crazy place to be. So, and it is a utopia and a crazy place to be. But yeah, at one point in time, starting to just apply for summer jobs on AngelList and just go through the list, applying for like all kinds of different startups. I did not really hear back from any of those startups, but I just kept applying. And then at like a startup event in Zurich, I by chance bumped into a guy who told me that he was a YC founder. So I talked to him about it and he was friendly. And he said, if I was interested, I could like send him my resume and he would forward that to the YC mailing list. So I followed up on that. I sent him my resume and made sure that he forwarded it to the group. And then in the, like overnight, I got just a bunch of interview invitations for summer jobs, summer internships. And yeah, talked to a bunch of founders. I don't remember what batch that was, but yeah, I talked to a bunch of founders that were just going through YC or coming out of YC and eventually like landed a job at a company called LendUp. And they were around, I think, pre-Series A at that point in time, so like less than 20 people. And yeah, working out of a small office in around Union Square in San Francisco. So I came over and just started working there as like a jack of all trades on the go-to-market, on the customer acquisition side of things. And honestly, like San Francisco is nothing what I imagined it to be. It was, not in a bad way.
What did you imagine?
Honestly, like I
what did you think beforehand? And then, yeah.
Yes. So, I mean, I read about it on TechCrunch, right? So it just seemed like, I imagine it to be like a Singapore and just like SkyTrains everywhere. I don't know, just like some kind of crazy, like, I guess.
Like a city of the future.
Exactly, a city of the future. And then you come to San Francisco and you realize like all of the VCs, they're like in this one strip mall at Sand Hill Road. They're all clustered in there, and like you drive there and like there's just one sign and all the VCs are in this one location. It is not really what you thought it would be. It's much less glamorous. But anyway, so I was at LendUp, and my now co-founder and I, we went to school together. So we'd always talked about like starting a company and wanting to come to San Francisco, to Silicon Valley, to check this out, to eventually be able to start a company. And just couldn't come up with any good ideas. But I think that the main point, or that the main thought that we had, was like, let's just build something. We'll figure it out. We'll just start building. And we decided to build an e-commerce store. And that e-commerce store that kind of like spiraled into a shipping software startup. We were selling just products on the internet, using Shopify, using Stripe, just selling stuff. And then realized that shipping is really hard. It was like, everything is easy to do. Shopify makes it easy. Stripe makes it easy. And when it came to shipping, you had to walk to the USPS store, which is not a fun experience. And why are the USPS APIs, the FedEx APIs, not as like easy and straightforward and developer friendly as the Stripe API or the Twilio API? So that was where this came from. And a founder I worked for, he always, at every team meeting, he would say stuff like, build something that's a painkiller, not a vitamin. And like that was he just kept saying that every time. And when we
That was Sasha.
That was Sasha, yes. And we found this shipping problem, we realized it is a real pain point. And like building something that's solving real pain points for real people is really gratifying. So that's how we got started. And that was like, I don't know, sometime between 2014 and 2015.
So you were pretty young when you started your company, right? This was just after you'd been a summer intern at LendUp. I think when I first started my first company, it was like, I was 21 when we started Kiko, which was funded by that first batch of YC. And like, I just felt like we had no idea what we were doing. You know, we did everything the wrong way. We fucked up like every single thing we did. Like from hiring employees to fundraising, like every single thing we did like the wrong way. I'm curious what the experience was like for you starting so young.
Yeah, it's a deep question. And I think we'll unpeel the onion. I'll start with the highest level answer. I think we just really did not know what we were getting ourselves into. Like we did not know what it means to start a company. We had some customer problem we wanted to solve. And in order to do that, we had to incorporate. And that's what we did. And like, when the question was, who's going to be the CEO, who's going to be something else, like I was just a little more extroverted than my co-founders. So we just said, yeah, sure, I'm the CEO. And I honestly had no idea, no idea what it meant to be a CEO. It's just very naive. I was probably 22 at that point in time. And it's being a CEO comes with responsibilities, comes with, like, I had no idea what that meant, and just signed up for it. And we had more important problems to solve at that point in time. Like it didn't mean anything to be a CEO of a company with like no employees, no revenue, no customers. So like our problems back then were to get customers, get revenue, start shipping packages, start hiring people. And then it just spiraled. I think as a CEO, you just have to like, Every day, I'm feeling like I'm behind. Like right now, we're maybe 170 people at Shippo. We're trying to be 300 people by the end of the year. As you said, before this, I was a summer intern. Like I am in no way qualified to be a CEO of a 300-person company, but you just have to learn on the job. And I think what San Francisco is incredible for is there are all these smart people. Like we met through friends of friends. Like a bunch of people I know have gone through exactly the same kind of stuff. They've made exactly the same kind of mistakes. And most people are just like pretty accessible to talk about these mistakes. But yeah, I mean, right now we're again in one of these stages where everything seems to be breaking in a good kind of way because we're growing fast. But if I just look back at all the mistakes I made, I think we'd be a much bigger company now if I didn't make these mistakes. But yeah, from hiring to firing to just communication, that made so many mistakes.
There's a couple of stories that reminds me of from my own experience. Like when we were four guys starting Justin TV, you know, the company that turned into Twitch. My co-founder, Michael, went and did the fundraising because he was like the business guy, right? And so we all had like almost no experience, but he was like the one who had worked in finance before, kind of in finance. He was a fundraiser for a Senate campaign, and they lost the Senate race. And so he was out of a job and he decided to join Justin TV. But I remember he went and fundraised and all the investors were like, are you the CEO? And he was kind of like, oh no, Justin is, because it was like my idea, I guess. And so I was default the CEO. And he actually changed it so that he was the CEO in the deck to solve that problem. And then that was like how we decided who would become the CEO. It was like a very awkward conversation between friends where he was like, yeah, I feel like it'll be easier for me to fundraise if I'm the CEO. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess like that's fine. And then for years, that's what, like, he was the CEO of the company. But we still made all these decisions together. It was like, we didn't really have like a real, you know, one throat to choke. And I mean, it was such an ass backwards way to decide like who would be CEO.
I know. Back then, it's just like, we had to file this. We had to file this letter or incorporation thing in Delaware. And this form needs to be filled out and we don't have much time. So let's fill it out and just put something in. So I don't know. I remember like my co-founder, Simon, he used to be much more of a engineering and product leader and didn't really want to come fundraising with us or with me. And then at some point, the VCs are just like, they want to see the co-founder, and he did not want to come. And I had to like tell him, like, VCs have Soylent and bananas in their fridge. You should just come and grab some Soylent. And yeah, he did show up.
You had to lure him with Soylent. I love that. The other thing you mentioned that resonated with me was saying, like, you know, before this, you were a summer intern, now you have 170 people and, you know, you don't know what you're doing right now. And I found that one of the things that I've observed about being a founder is that you always feel like you're failing to some degree, because you're either actually failing and then you have to figure things out and it feels pretty bad, or you're succeeding and you're doing something you've never done before because your company's bigger. You know, you've never managed a 170 person organization, or next year you'll never have managed a 300 person organization. And, you know, your functional teams now need to be cross-functional. Your cross-functional teams now need to go back to being functional, or whatever it is. And so there's this feeling of always drowning as a founder, you know, even when you're winning.
No, I think that's exactly right. And it's like always like a little uncomfortable. And like last year I made the mistake of like once just saying to a few people that after I've hired some people that, you know, I feel like I'm living my best life right now. I made all these hires and everything's great and everything's awesome. And then one of them had to leave for unexpected reasons. I was like, oh my God, I jinxed it. I should not have said that. But yes, I feel like whenever you start getting into a spot where things start feeling good, suddenly something very unexpected and very fucked up happens and you have to deal with it.
So tell me about some of those times. Like, one of the things I read was that you had to pitch for your seed round 125 investors to get to 10 yeses.
Yes. So, but honestly, like in hindsight, I don't think that was one of the hardest things. Like I got quite a lot of energy out of it. But yes, the true story is like back then I really did not know how to pitch people and who to pitch. I think by now, you know, you only want to pitch like real angels and real funds, not people who've done an investment once in their life. And even though they're taking meetings, like this meeting probably not lead to anything. You also don't want to take meetings with funds that are not investing in at your stage, right? Like at that point in time, I just didn't know any of these rules. And I was pitching anyone who was willing to listen and anyone who's ever invested in a company before. So we got a lot of meetings. So that's good. We got a lot of meetings and a lot of no's. And at the end, I think I had a spreadsheet where I just kept track of people. It was more than 125 people that we've met. And it was a good way to practice pitching, though. I think at the end of the day, I've just heard all of the questions that people would ask before. And then I was able to have good answers when the right people were asking similar questions. But yeah, I mean, if I just have to think about things that were really hard, I think there are a few things that are really hard. When you start a company, you bring on a bunch of people and like, they're all generalists. No one knows what they're doing. They're all like the kind of summer intern types of people, but they're hardworking, they're hard charging, they're like a good group of folks and they're trying to figure it out. And then when things start working, you realize that actually you need specialists. And those people that have gotten you this far, especially the early group, that's like the first 10, the first 15 people who feel like, I don't know, you should be loyal to them. Like at some point you realize that in order for you to get to the next stage, you need to bring on people that have done it before, and you need to find different roles for these people or for the existing people, or you need to manage them out. Like that was one stage in the company that I personally found really hard, because I am a loyal person. I want to be able to have people in the company grow with the company. But then if the company is growing too fast, it is the responsibility of the CEO to make those hard decisions and to bring other people in that can help the company grow faster. And like, I think by now I have the kind of vocabulary or mental models to articulate it in a better way, where like the right way is like to look at it is that, I don't know, like you might own or the team member, they might own all of marketing, but the company stays small, or they own like a part of marketing, but it's a much bigger pie. But I think at that point in time, I just didn't have the right words to articulate what was going on and the changes that we're going through. And probably burned a few bridges there that were just like not fun to burn. Yeah, I bet you've had those experiences as well. I bet every founder has gone through exactly this.
Yeah, I've had a lot of those experiences, because in the beginning, when you're starting off, you know, especially having never worked at a real company, like I had only been a summer intern as well, you know, the first people who will join your team, you're like, okay, you're the head of marketing, you're the VP of engineering, you're the CTO, and it's kind of like the quality or the experience level of the person that you can hire to be the CTO of your company at a 10-person company and a 50-person company and a 150-person company and a 1,000-person company are completely different. And so, you know, the way I started phrasing it to my team, I remember, was that, you know, if you are a successful executive at a company, you might go to manage a group of like 500 people or like 1,000 people after a 30-year career, right? And so that means if you start from zero or 1% or whatever, the number of doublings, that's like you have to double your headcount that you can manage every, it's like 5 years, I think, right? Six doublings, 5 years. And that's a lot of time to do it. But in a startup, you know, you might double your headcount every 1 year, 18 months, you know, and if you were then be the head of the engineering group or the marketing group or the go-to-market or whatever. And so just from a pure statistical standpoint, it is very improbable that any of us like are qualified to do it, and we'll do it that fast. And there really shouldn't be any self-judgment around that. And as the CEO, you get like a little bit of special support from the investors and from your executives that you're hiring who maybe have experience and can lend you experience. But we don't really have that same infrastructure for the early team members. And so that's what causes this kind of mismatch, you know?
Yes. Yeah, no. And then that happens every few years again. Or like if you do well, it happens every few years again. So it's a conversation that never stops. Like a conversation that I think one can get better at. But yeah, I think at the beginning, it's just this kind of fear. If you've never fired anyone before, you've never had these hard conversations before. And I think most people, like most kids, even growing up, they're taught that these hard conversations are uncomfortable, and you don't want to be in this uncomfortable situation. It triggers fight or flight, and like you feel your body being really tense. So yeah, I wish someone would have taught me earlier how to give like honest feedback without making it tense or uncomfortable.
Yeah, how did you get comfortable with that?
So, I mean, I think what you said about the support group, like I do have a few CEO friends that I talk to a bunch, but then also a coach that I talk to. And I think these conversations are not less uncomfortable right now, they are less uncomfortable. Like I coming from, you know, I used to be the kind of person who would like avoid giving feedback or like just suck things up or be like, oh, it wasn't that bad, until like it all accumulates and it's just too bad. And then you have to have a really serious conversation. And I think it is probably the natural to a bunch of people to act that way. So I like by now I've like started just even small feedback points that are not like too big of a deal. Like I'm just raising them. And because they're not too big of a deal, I can do that in a nice and friendly way so that no one like, so that these things get out of the way and nothing like adds up and accumulates. And that's helped me quite a lot. And at the beginning, I thought I'd be petty raising tiny things and like just always giving feedback about like issues that are not a big deal. But by now, it just feels much better to get it off my plate. And I think it's also much better for the team to know what I'm actually thinking. And that's been good. But the really uncomfortable conversations, they're still uncomfortable. But I think by now, I also think about it from the perspective of, like, by now I'm dealing with team members who are like more senior, more of the execs. So they've had those conversations before. They should, like, I'm not as much managing them, but like, we're always in communication around like what's going on, what's going well, what's not going well. So it's also just become easier as I'm dealing with more senior people. But yeah, at the beginning, when you're just a group of young people who've never had jobs before, it's really hard because there are a lot of feelings, lots of ego.
Yeah, I had the exact same experience. I was so scared to give people feedback, and I thought it was something negative. And it was only very recently, you know, a couple of years ago, that I realized like, oh, feedback is a gift. You know, getting it, and even if it's hard to hear, and giving it, even if it's hard to deliver and hard for the other person to hear, is the only way that you can improve. And so really having that mindset shift helped me a lot, you know, in terms of just being willing to be like, I'm going to be uncomfortable in this moment, but it's because I'm doing it in service of this other person.
And most people think feedback is like inherently a negative word, but feedback is not criticism. Like, feedback can also be positive feedback, which, by the way, was also something that I had to learn in a way that, like, you know, for myself, my motivation comes intrinsically. So I kind of know whether or not I've done well. I don't need someone else to tell me. I look at the outcome like, okay, this is a good outcome. But then most people, they do want to hear it from others. And it is like talking about the responsibilities of a CEO. Like, I've never really realized that people would care about what I have to say or the praise that I have to give. But it turns out that coming from a CEO, it's so much more meaningful. And it's also very meaningful if you don't say anything positive about it. But yeah, that was another like new learning, not super recently, but I think as part of the journey of a CEO, that actually people care very much about what I have to say. And then if I don't say it, like, people will notice too.
Yeah, they care the most. They're like dissecting everything you say and talking about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. And easy to be misunderstood as well.
Yeah, the over-communicating. I think there's people don't realize how much communication and over-communication and feedback and like that as a CEO who's of a growing company, you have to work on that constantly and improve. I guess so few people have had the experience, you know, it's not really something that people understand. It's in the zeitgeist.
Yeah. I think on that one, I think it's again, one of these things I've been able to just rely on my more senior leaders now to like amplify what I'm saying, to help me reiterate, help me clarify when people misunderstand. So that's been really good. But it feels like these kinds of resources, they become available to you as you grow. Like when we were a really small business, just getting started, none of these more senior people would have wanted to work at Shippo. So it's more like an evolution of we're now this size and then we can attract these kinds of people. And I bet like 2-3 years from now, we can attract very different people again. And it'll again be eye-opening around like, wow, this is what best in class looks like. So I'm looking forward to that.
One thing you touched on was building a support network and a coach, getting a CEO coach. Can you talk a little bit about how you learned to ask for help?
So I think the coach came from a pretty specific story. I was working with the team and there was one engineer and the engineer quit. And like in the conversation after he quit, like asking why, I asked him why. And he was just saying like, well, you're not at all like Steve Jobs, and he's just expecting something else from a CEO. And I think he had lots of other reasons as well. But in that moment, like that just hit really hard. So I was talking to coaches that are out there, and like also asked one of my board members to see if there's any coach that I could work with. And when I went to see that coach, I think the first thing I was expecting when I asked him was like, can you teach me how to be like Steve Jobs? And and he's like, no, wait, like that's not really what coaching's about. So that was a fun conversation. And I think it was much more just about getting to understand like what leadership style I'm comfortable with, like what's most authentic to me, and then amplifying or like working with that instead of trying to be someone else. And that's helped me quite a lot as well. I think like at the beginning of this journey, I was much more trying to be like this professional Laura at work who's different from like the Laura in private life. And it's just very tiring to try to be a different persona at work than you are at home. So yeah, that's been a really good journey. That's just, you know, lifting some weight off my shoulders. And Then let's see, around like how to ask for help. I think honestly, like Silicon Valley does make it easy to for founders because there's so many founders around, and like I'm just as we're talking, like you have stories that kind of sound like mine, and like just like even without asking for help, like just hearing those stories, knowing that other people have gone through the exact same thing and it's not just me, makes it a lot easier. So yeah, I've liked that a lot about San Francisco. I think that's one of the main upsides. You're feeling less lonely, you're feeling less like you're fucking up, but you're realizing that actually everyone's going through the same stuff.
Yeah, it's surprising how much that's the case. You know, before our conversation, I probably could have said, here's what I think your startup journey was like, you know, and outlined a lot of experiences that I had that, you know, here's like the awkward way that, you know, you had to let go of the first employee because you failed to give him feedback for like a year, you know, like things like that. And it's like, I've had that same experience. It sounds like you've had many of them. And then there's hundreds of CEOs who've had the same, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's funny how that works. And that's one of the things I really love about Silicon Valley. But I wanted to dig in on one thing you said, which is finding your authentic leadership style and learn more about kind of how you did that. Like how did you become comfortable with that? Because for myself, for a long time, I just had this vision of like what a CEO was supposed to be, you know, and I was trying to be this other thing that, and I looked up to friends of mine who are being more successful, like Drew from Dropbox or something like that. I was like, I just need to be like that, you know? And I was never really happy trying to do that, but it took me so long to like be comfortable with just like, okay, I'm going to be the best Justin I can be, you know, and I'm curious what that journey was like for you.
Yeah, what it was just like for me was, as you said, when you try to be someone else, it's just really, really tiring and always feels like you're a bit behind. And at some point, I think it was probably with my coach, just talking about like what I believe in and many conversations about like just how I wish I acted versus like how I actually showed up. And that then helped with realizing, first of all, that there's a discrepancy. Realizing that it feels like it's a first step to the solution. And then getting there, I think it was about being just very honest also with the new team members that I brought on board about like what my weaknesses are and then what I'm trying to work on. And I think at the beginning when the team was very small and it was like kind of trying to be someone I'm not, team members might not know what my weaknesses were, and then they were also projecting who they thought I was, and just like being very honest about this is where I'm good at, this is what I'm not good at, like these are things that I can help with, these are things where just I don't have a strong opinion about and you should just figure it out, and like these are my operating principles, this is what gets me really annoyed. And like I think these are like writing out the operating principles has been super helpful for me as well, because then just acknowledging like this is what triggers me. And I've always known that these things trigger me. I just have never wanted to admit it. I just wanted to like hide it, or like I didn't want to be triggered. I wanted to pretend as if I wasn't triggered. I wanted to be that kind of better person. But no, like now I'm just admitting that these things trigger me and this is how I like to work, and like just being very upfront and honest about that. And then for me, it helps a tiny bit to be over Zoom instead of in person. And I don't mean that for the strategic meetings. I mean like, when you're in the office, like every second you're in the office, you're just being watched. Like when you're just getting coffee, when you're going to the kitchen, people are always looking at my facial expression. And like, I just have a resting bitch face between meetings because I'm tired. And I don't know, I'm just like relaxing my facial muscles. I'm not always smiling. And people misinterpret that at times. Yeah, so it's been really good to be able to turn the camera off and then go to my, get my coffee and not smiling, and then go back and be back like full on during meetings.
That resonates with me actually, because I remember one time there was like a rumor that I was like super pissed in the office. You know, I also like look like,
yeah,
I have an intense look a lot of times when I'm, you know, just thinking about something or whatever. And people were legitimately worried about like my state of mind, you know, because of like my facial expressions while walking to the water cooler or whatever.
Yeah, no, but that happens, right? Like people see me and my co-founder in a conference room at a time that like we don't have our schedule one-on-one, and they're like, what are they talking about? Are they talking about layoffs? No, we're just catching up. I think that is a strange adjustment though, that people care so much about like your facial expressions, what you said, what you didn't say. Yeah, I was never that super popular kid in school, so like no one really cared about what I said or didn't say in high school or college. So that was like a strange adjustment.
For sure. I want to ask about if there were any like mindset shifts that you had to change as you've like kind of, what you came from Germany, right, which is probably, I'm assuming, kind of like a much different culture than was here in Silicon Valley. And as you came here and grew up here, what changed for you?
So one of my friends said something that I found quite insightful, which is like, live like a European, but work like an American. And I think that is the right attitude. I do think people here in the US are much better about just giving it all at work and much more passionate about work. And the Germans or Europeans in general, I think there's much more of a work and life is separated and is, I don't know, you go home, you don't think about it, work anymore. For me, that's super hard. I just love what I'm doing so much. I want to think about it all the time. But what's changed as my mindset? I think you think much bigger here in Silicon Valley. It's just anything is possible. Like at the beginning, I used to pitch European VCs as well, in addition to American VCs. And they always wanted to know what the exit strategy was. They wanted to know what the 3 or 5 year plan was. And that was when we were still like a tiny company. There was no 3 to 5 year plan. I can't even tell you what's going to happen next year, next month. But yeah, I think people were just much more narrow or smaller in their thinking. And in San Francisco, you know, people are working on colonizing Mars. They're working on all kinds of just crazy shit. So like figuring shipping out in comparison to that is a much smaller challenge. So it just puts things into perspective. And it makes me think much bigger as well. Like some of my board members, they ask me like, what about, I don't know, shipping to Mars? It is a crazy idea. We're far from that, but at least they're asking these kinds of questions. They're not asking me about when I'm selling the company. So yeah, I think much bigger picture thinking or the ambitions are significantly larger. I also think there's much less hierarchy in the US. Like people are willing to talk to entrepreneurs no matter where they are in their career. They're always willing to pay forward, which I think is quite special about the place. And then at least until fairly recently, even now, I think entrepreneurs, they like, it is an exciting job. Like people want to be entrepreneurs, which is different in Europe. Like in Europe, I think people want to be bankers, they want to be consultants, they don't want to be entrepreneurs. And it is kind of awesome that people want to be entrepreneurs here in the US.
Awesome. I think earlier we talked a little bit about the toughest moments, and I suggested that one of them might have been fundraising, but you said that wasn't that hard.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to that and ask you, what have been the toughest moments of founding?
I think there are different tough moments. Like fundraising was not that tough. I think it's just something that keeps occurring, a necessary evil, but it feels kind of different because you're working with VCs, and VCs are supposed to say no. That's kind of their job. So I want to say, it is their job. I still take it personal, but it does not feel that bad. I think this really the relationship stuff, the people stuff in the office at work that contribute to some of the hardest moments. Like you are not prepared for having conversations with a team member who's gotten really sick and therefore has to quit. Like these are just conversations that no one's prepared you for. And I think it's like a bunch of these conversations of like taking care of the team and realizing that you need to do right by the team. And then you also have business goals, because when someone tells you like they've gotten really sick and they need to quit, like it's someone you've worked with, you really care about them. But then immediately your mind kind of also goes to, what about this year's goals? Like, how are we going to do that? And it's a hard balance.
Yeah. I think that people often don't see the emotional weight that it is to be a founder and to carry these difficult conversations you have no preparation for, right? Like you have no experience. And it was the same for me. Like I had never had a real job before starting a company. And then I was managing people. And then I was like not giving them feedback. And then I was letting them go and couldn't look them in the eye when I was saying it because I had let the situation go too far south. And, you know, that is so difficult at times to have that experience.
You know, we are as founders in a very fortunate position, and like that kind of it is a responsibility, but it's also just really grateful for that responsibility. I don't think anyone would have hired me to be their CEO, but there are times like when the company is much smaller and we tried to scale something up that wasn't ready to scale yet, and we had to like make a riff there, and it was the right thing to do for the company. But I did not know how to articulate that in the best way. And then you read the Glassdoor reviews and you're like, No, I'm not like that kind of monster that you're describing me to be. I was really trying to do what I thought was best for the company. But these are really painful moments. Yeah, there is one Glassdoor review that's like it's very, very painful from, I don't know, 4 years ago.
Can I ask you what it said?
I honestly don't remember the details anymore, but it's pretty long. And it was about like how the founders had no idea what they were doing and were really bad at running this business. And just like that kind of stuff or that kind of narrative, it did feel vindictive, but it was as part of like one riff that we made because of an acquisition strategy that didn't scale. But yeah, I think it was painful because part of it rang true. Like we really have never done this before, but like it was coming from the perspective of, we were being deliberately assholes about it, which was for sure not the case.
Yeah, there's this assumption of malintent and like you don't get the benefit of the doubt, right? And it feels like that can be super tough. I mean, I've had more than my fair share of those where people are like, he's not focused, he's not interested in this, we're too scattered, we hired the wrong people as managers, and like the long laundry list of things I've done to people that they've written about on Glassdoor can be painful.
Yeah, I think the reality is also like probably you are already, or at least I was already aware of like some of these were mistakes or like some of these were maybe hiring mistakes or whatever, but you have to fix them and fixing them is painful, but not fixing them would be even worse. But fixing them means that you have to let go of a few people or like downsize a function that didn't work out or cut a launch that was not good. And then people, I think by now, if there's one thing I learned was just to be like brutally transparent about this and just like not try to hide it from people, but just have honest conversations about it. But I think back then you also have the thought of like, what can I share? What can I not share? But in hindsight, I think transparency always wins. But yeah, it is on the CEO to make these hard decisions. And then others from the outside or like others in the team, they see it from a different perspective.
Yeah, it's such a different perspective from the ground versus from the CEO seat, you know, like when we were 10 people or whatever, or 15 people, I'd hear about things that happened at big companies, I'd be like, oh, those big companies are so stupid. Why don't they just fix their problem? But then when you have a company that's hundreds of people, let alone thousands, fixing problems takes time. And it's like personnel replacement and changing your goals. But you can't do that like every month or whatever. So, you know, oftentimes there's these situations on the ground that seem very obvious how to fix, but then from the as management of the company, it's like maybe that's just not the priority this week, and there's like a laundry list of other problems that you have to deal with.
Yeah, no, I think from an idealistic perspective, it should be easy to fix, but then when you're in the weeds and you have to execute this yourself, you realize that there are a bunch of operational constraints and just, yeah, there are real constraints, and it just takes a little longer to fix. You can't just rip off the Band-Aid immediately. There's some other things that need to happen first, you know?
Yeah, so we might have covered some of this, but I'm curious what it's been like for you to kind of grow up in tech as a leader in Silicon Valley and how that's affected you.
Yeah, I think it's a kind of weird thing. I started the company when I was around 22, I think, and then I came of age in Silicon Valley, meaning like I was an adult at 22 already, but like turning into a real adult. And I think it is an incredible opportunity, just like starting with the real positives here. I think no one would have given me this kind of responsibility at any other company. Like I would have gotten an entry level job at any other company. And like it's an entire career compressed into like 5-6 years at Shippo, which is amazing. And it's an awesome fast track. And then being able to work with best in class people and learn from them. Like by now we're able to hire them and I'm able to work alongside of them. I'm able to experience them in meetings myself and just like be with people in a room who have a higher bar than I am, who've done this many times at other companies before. So that's incredible. I'm outside of San Francisco right now. The other day I went into the city to like take a few meetings. And when I'm in the city, it's just, I can't sleep as well. Like my heart rate is higher. I feel the energy, the stress level of like, I have to work. And there are all these startups out there and like everyone's trying to be competitive and everyone's raised bigger rounds than we have. So how do we, like, it's just a very real feeling. And these are not things that we should want to compete on, but like right now there are no dinner parties, obviously, but like when there were dinner parties, you run into this meeting and like this 21-year-old has raised $300 million. And you're like, oh my God, I'm like 2016, only raised $100 million. Yes, so these are just, I don't know, it's just crazy comparisons. And you're always on this treadmill, which is, quite frankly, like, I think for the stage that we're at, still a good treadmill to be on. Like, I'm not super into the giving up all of my edges just yet, because I feel like these edges, they push me to where we need to be. They push us to push me to work harder. But these edges are real. And like, yeah, in San Francisco, I can't sleep that well. I wake up at night thinking that I missed my meetings. I dream about like being in the car to Palo Alto and not finding the Sand Hill Road office that I'm supposed to be at. So it is kind of crazy.
I know it's people don't believe it, but it's crazy how much the comparison monkey mind works, even when you're successful. You know, anyone out there is going to be like, oh, Laura's like in her 20s, has a 170 person company that's raised $100 million, that's used by 50,000 merchants, right, or more. And that's like a huge success. And then you can be inside yourself saying, oh, but there's this other kid who's raised $300 million. And that's how I felt. I was like, even after we sold Twitch, I was like, well, my friends started Dropbox or Airbnb or Stripe or, you know, any of these other numerous companies that are orders of magnitude larger. Like, I didn't feel good about it when I was in that comparison mindset.
Yeah, you're always comparing yourself to other people out there, and there's always someone who's done something bigger and better. But yeah, I think, like, I know that you've gotten really into just shedding that those mental models. I think I'm personally still at a stage where it helps me, like, it serves a purpose that I'm like kind of comparing myself to other people. And it's not, given that I'm aware of it and I know what purpose it serves, I still enjoy it as a tool of like, yes, I should put in the extra hour and I should like push myself a little harder, because we're not there yet. Like, we're very far from achieving our vision, and it is exhilarating. Like, everything's breaking and it's crazy, and it's like, I don't know how we're gonna hit our revenue targets, but it will work out one way or the other. And it is kind of this awesome feeling to still be on the treadmill.
Well, yeah, and so comparison actually isn't bad, right? Like, when I started my wellness-focused journey, I was like, oh, I should stop comparing myself to others. The thing that really helped me was to realize, like, oh, like wanting other people to accept me or approve of me or wanting to be successful, like comparing myself to other people, those were all tools, right? Like, they were ways of coping with the world. And because when I was a kid, I didn't feel like I got that attention or whatever. And so I had all these tools of like, okay, I'm going to make myself into something super powered and be successful, and then I'll be liked, you know, or whatever. And the first step for me was to accept, like, oh, that's like a tool to you that I was using. And then I could make a choice of like, okay, is that the right tool that I still want to use? And it sounds like for you, I mean, as you go down the journey of becoming aware of it, then it's an opportunity for you to continue using that tool that you have, or like eventually to make a different choice if it serves you.
Exactly. If it stops serving me at some point, I think you're exactly right. Like, you can retire your tools. Like, a tool that's serving you today might not serve you a year from now or 2 years from now, which is continuously going through your tool set and seeing what's still working and what's not working. I think it's just, you start suffering when you're like stuck in those mental models that just have stopped serving you, but you're still subconsciously applying them. So yeah, I totally agree with that. But I think, yeah, for me, it's often I look at things and I'm like, it's like, if this person has been able to do it, like, I should be able to do it as well. And that's kind of the comparison that I often like have for myself. Or like, how come that this like nonsensical business has raised this amount of money and like this business, yeah, very sensible, like everyone needs to ship. Like, and then, yeah, these are the kinds of comparisons that sometimes come to me.
Okay, switching gears a little bit. I know you've talked about like how in the past you didn't want to be painted as a woman founder, right? Or a female founder, but now you're more open to talking about it. I'm wondering, like, are there ways that you think it's been different or more challenging for you? Because when I was starting off, like, no one took us seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was partially the content of our business, which was like us trying to make a live streaming reality show about ourselves. But also, you know, even after we pivoted from that, we were a platform for anyone to broadcast. People just thought we were incompetent, not good, like not serious. And I felt like it was, you know, I would look at like competitors of ours who were, the founders were older, they were maybe a little more professional, and they would raise like a lot more money. They would kind of be considered much more seriously. And that always pissed me off, like a tremendous amount. And I just wonder if, you know, what your experience was like as a young founder, but also as a woman.
So honestly, I do think that this, like, being young I've seen people make comments about that much more than about being female. So I, So let's see, on the young founder side, like I've walked into meetings earlier on where like the partners asked, like, are you of age yet to sign this contract? I'm like, haha, that's so funny. And everyone thought it was funny. It's not actually funny. And I think it's also an issue, at least like I sometimes perceive it as an issue in hiring, like wanting to be able to attract leaders that are very senior to work for someone who's much younger than them. So I've seen that. In terms of being a woman founder, I think, honestly, like at the beginning when I came to San Francisco, it was like this, the female founder conversation was, it was not a conversation just yet. So it was not something that I ever thought about as a limiting factor. And then the business that we have, it's an API business, a very technical business. So it feels like most of the time people talk about just, or we lead with the metrics and the gender stuff. I've never seen that really come up. By now, I've seen being a female founder actually be positive in hiring. Like I see people who want to work for a female founder who like are excited about that. So that's been a plus recently even. But yeah, being a founder is already hard enough. I don't want to think about like being a female founder. So it is one of these things.
You're not trying to put yourself in the box.
Exactly. I'm not trying to put myself into that box, but like, obviously I am a female founder. Like one of the things that come up for women, not for men, is like fertility preservation. And that's something that I'm thinking about right now. It's like, there are things that are just unique to women that like are more stressful at some point. Like I do want to have babies and then I have to figure out like how to be pregnant while also running a company. So I envision that this like being a woman founder will actually have like raise much more challenges for me in the future than it's done for me in the past, because I'm just not at that stage yet where like I have to figure out how to be pregnant and run a company, or figure out how to nurse a child while being in meetings. But I'll face that at some point in time.
Well, I'm glad that you don't have, feel like it's affected you thus far. That reminds me of one time I was asked, like, what's it like to be an Asian founder? You know, and I was like, oh, I didn't realize it was any different. You know,
it's exactly. It should not. I don't want to say that. Like, I know that a lot of like even friends of mine have had the experience, like women founders who've had the experience of it was actually different for them. So I don't want to say it's not different across the board. But for me, it's not been different for me. And I've tried to like make a point that this is, you know, we're talking about our business metrics. We're talking, I think in meetings, I actually come across as a pretty intense person as well. So like, Maybe all of that stuff helps, but I've never had it as a challenge.
It's the German accent.
Exactly. It's the German accent and talking about shipping.
Yeah. The last question I have written down here is about fears and challenges. Like, are there any that you faced?
Fears and challenges. I think there's always the fear for, I was just articulating that to the team and I was really hoping not to be misunderstood, but like my main fear is I don't want to be there 10 years from now and like see another company that's done exactly what I'm thinking about and what I'm discussing with my executive team today. And then look at like, oh wow, they did exactly what we wanted to do and they're super successful now and we didn't manage to do what we said we'd do. So right now it's a fear around the execution. And like, I'm trying to summarize it as like, you want to be the Shopify, not the Volusion, right? Like how do you, they have the exact same idea, building storefronts or website builder for e-commerce stores, like kind of the same idea, but like one became Shopify and the other is Volusion. So how do we not end up being the Volusion? How do we become the Shopify? And at this point, it is a challenge about execution. So getting the right people there, getting people like inspired to do what I want them to do. And yeah, but it is like, in meetings, like as you said, like sometimes you're 100 or we're 170 something people now, we're going to be bigger. It's just hard to convince people to do something that's like slightly different or even very different. I'm like, we just have to do this. Otherwise, like if we don't take this risk, like someone else might. And then if it turns out to be what turns you into a giant company, I don't want to be there and just look at someone else who's done exactly what I thought we should do.
Amazing. Well, that can be a huge driver of, you know, motivator, right? Is that
yeah, but fear it's also just a huge thing around like, you have to be good at executing. You have to pick up the pace, the velocity. People need to be aligned. People all need to be working towards the same goal. And it is a very different kind of challenge than when we were a small business. It was just like about just grinding as hard as I could. And like it is not necessarily this kind of like coordinating, making people work together well, and assembling the right group of people, just a very different kind of like role than the role that I started out with.
How is that, like, do you like it? Like oftentimes people start a startup and they're like, because they're a programmer or a salesperson or a product person, and you know, they love doing that part, and then they grow it, and all of a sudden 5 years later they're like, oh, I'm a manager, people manager, you know, primarily. Do you like how it's changed for you?
Yeah. So I think the very simple answer here is like people like doing things that they're good at or that like that they're successful at. It's like right now we're doing well. So I like it, and I'm seeing the positive results of what we're doing. I think it would be very different if it wasn't going as well. But when things are going well, there's a big pull from the market, and just like e-commerce is exploding and e-commerce enablement is exploding alongside of it. And there's such a big pull from the market, you can kind of afford making a few small mistakes and it's still working really well. But yeah, right now I'm feeling good about it so far.
All right. I hope that continues. Yeah. Forever. That's amazing.
No, this is great. This is great. Kind of therapeutic.
I'm glad. All right, and that's a wrap. A couple of key takeaways from my conversations with Laura. As a founder, you always feel like you're drowning. Laura pitched 125 investors to get 10 yeses, and she said that wasn't even the worst part. I found that if you're a founder, you are always on the edge of your own competence. You know, if your company is growing, then you are always figuring out how to do something new, and that can feel very daunting. So it's normal to feel like things aren't working. Number two, uncomfortable conversations, well, sometimes they never get easier. But feedback is a gift. A great way that worked for Laura is to give small feedback without waiting for things to accumulate into a big, serious conversation. Number three, find your authentic leadership style. Laura wouldn't be where she is today if she pretended to be like Steve Jobs. She's great because she decided to be the best Laura she can be. And that reminds me of that conversation I had with Steve Huffman, CEO of Reddit, on the podcast, where he talked about finding his own path and being the best Steve that he can be. Number four, comparison is a mental model and a tool that often helps founders excel. However, it's just a tool. You can use it for your own benefit, but you can also use it to torture yourself. And sometimes it's time to retire it when it doesn't serve you anymore. Okay, next week we're switching it up and we're going to have another member from the Sway House join me on the podcast. He's got literally millions of followers and is one of the most watched Gen Z VCs around the world. Can you guess who it is? It's my friend Josh Richards. Follow us on socials and we're going to tell you more about the episode coming soon. All right, guys, see you next Tuesday. Love you all. See you later.